Hi everyone, I'm Megan, and welcome to Word Crash, the game show where questionable plots compete for your vote to win a place in the Word Crash Hall of Infamy. Let's meet our contestants. She's a YA author who's never been afraid to let her geek hang out and belts out any song she can think of at the top of her lungs. Please welcome the editor-in-residence at Brighthive, Justine Manzano.
Hello.
Next, she's a writer, VTuber, narrative designer, and indie game dev who's become obsessed with lacto fermentation and makes a mean pickled serrano pepper. Please welcome to the show, Caitlin Sandel.
Hello.
Well, nothing left to do but get to it. Let's play Word Crash. Grab your bucket and mop, because it's time for Squeaky Clean. Reboot a gritty book or movie to remove the grit. Justine, what story is getting dumped in the bath today?
The Hunger Games.
The Hunger Games. Okay, well, what do we do to The Hunger Games to make it less dark and gritty?
Well, The Hunger Games is very much about a bunch of people murdering each other, which we gotta get rid of, right? So what else can we make The Hunger Games about but making food? So The Hunger Games is now a cooking competition.
What I'm hearing here is that you want to do The Hunger Games British Bake Off.
Yes.
Tell us about Katniss. How has she changed?
Perhaps she would be gathering some ingredients from the woods. Her district would probably be a mining district still, but maybe like salt mines, perhaps still taking the place of her sister who really can't cook. And she doesn't want her to make a fool out of herself and be embarrassed on a national stage. So she volunteers to cook.
She's running around in those woods, right? Hunting for mushrooms.
Yes.
Being very like, oh, look at this ingredient. Isn't it perfect? Isn't this natural world perfect? And she gets home and her sister's crying and everyone's like, what? What? I have to cook. I have to cook. No, you don't have to cook. I volunteer.
I volunteer to cook. Very emotional.
You still have to provide that pressure, though. I would think that you've got to throw bullies into the mix or it's not going to work. You need some mild threat to kind of establish the forward momentum and the pressure. I think that it's possible that there may be people from the Capital Cooking Guild who are like judging folks, and the result of the competition may actually affect the reputation of the district.
There you go. Another thing I was thinking was that the different districts have different ingredients that they specialize in. The win would get some kind of precious ingredient that isn't available to everybody. It's only available in the capital.
Some very expensive ingredient from the secret district that doesn't exist anymore. No, that's too dark. I'm sorry, I'm going back dark.
They don't exist anymore because everybody moved out of shame when they lost 1 year. It was such a huge scandal that everyone moved out because they were like, forget it. I don't want to be in this district anymore. And they moved to other districts.
You know, there could still definitely be drama here because have you watched the judges on things like the British Bake Offs and what was it? Chopped?
Chopped. Oh, yeah. The more American you get, the meaner they are.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. So Katniss absolutely wants to win this now. She wants to win for her sister. She wants to win for her district. What do the guys think of her?
Well, I think PETA would just be a tragic character in this situation because PETA is a baker in a salt district. So what would he do? he would have a hard time. And if he's competing too, like she would definitely have to protect him. Mm-hmm. Gail's a harder one. What would Gail be doing?
I feel like Gail's the sort of green man archetype, living out in a cabin in the woods, living the lifestyle 24/7.
Of the gatherer?
Of the gatherer, yes. Full-time forager, and possibly provides what scant grain is available for PETA to practice his art.
Is Gail a vegetarian?
I don't think it comes up. I think that nobody has had any meat in this district in a long time, and then they're sort of fine with it.
It's a non-issue. Maybe meat is a district thing.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, in the second book, there can be a really climactic battle where everybody has to work with meat.
And they haven't in very long time. So this is a huge
There's
deal.
No discussion of what animal the meat comes from. It's just meat.
That's terrifying, actually.
We're supposed to be rebooting this nice and squeaky clean, right?
It's clean. It's clean.
It's mystery meat, though. It's clean.
It's not mystery meat if nobody acknowledges the mystery.
Mm. The second book could be some kind of, you know, high school kitchen kind of thing. Mystery meat is totally something that people just innately understand as part of cafeteria culture.
It's science meat. Made by scientists. Processed, not shown.
The second book is all about cooking for the younger audience, maybe.
But we can't get ahead of ourselves with the second book. We need to focus on the first book. So bring it back to the first book. We know how Katniss gets involved. Are we still going to do the thing where they go to the Capitol? What are we doing?
They could. They could try all different types of new foods to give them ideas. And they could also be there to try to test themselves and learn new recipes while they're there, or new techniques. That could be like our training montage. They're learning new techniques for cooking for their composition.
Kaylin, what new technique does Katniss have to learn?
Calphalon. She has to learn how to use this mystical metal that has been created by the brilliant capital scientists. And it's different from anything she's worked with before. So it's like, ooh, how do you use this calphalon? And I think that's a big challenge for everybody but the district participants who, like, you know, they've gotten to work with it before. So districts one and two still have the home advantage. And I think they're a little mean, a little rude. Maybe they take steps to sabotage other people's food.
I would like to take this moment to point out that the entire country's name is Panem.
Panem.
Yeah. Which is actually from Hunger Games.
Yes.
Panem.
Well, you know, linguistically speaking, it's supposed to mean that.
For anyone listening, this episode is certainly not being brought to you by Calphalon.
No.
I would certainly take their money, but this is, I'm not getting paid for it, so.
Calphalon can send me products. That being said, I think that if we're dropping the costumes and spectacle, it's not the Hunger Games. So we got to still keep some of that. The stylists that make everybody look really cool, but also, like, you know, may have their own agenda. Nobody really knows.
Could that be about presentation of the food?
Ooh, next level up, right?
We could have a stylist working with Katniss to make her food look like a spectacle in some way.
And Katniss doesn't want anything to do with it. She's just like, I just want to make food that tastes good.
Exactly. It's all about the nutrients and needing to eat, right? But everyone else is like, make it look pretty. And small portions that look cute on a plate.
And we have, like, Lenny Kravitz grab her hand and do a little drizzling motion over a plate. And she's like, wow, it looks so different now.
I'm now picturing Lenny Kravitz in this role, and it's brilliant.
What is the name of, may the odds ever be in your favor? Who is she again?
Athique Trinket?
I was going to say that she probably says, may the sauce be ever in your favor.
Athique Trinket was her name, so Athique Truffle.
Every truffle is good.
Truffle!
Yeah.
Fantastic.
I like that.
But Lenny Kravitz's character was Cinnamon. Cinnamon.
A lot of food names anyway.
So I asked because it'd be great if there was an argument between Katniss and Effie where Katniss is like, gold foil doesn't taste like anything. Why would I put it in my food? You know, and she's like, because it makes it look amazing. They want to see this.
It's all about the presentation.
I think we keep the train ride.
It's a good thing. There's, in fact, food and drink feature very prominently in that, even in the original. So no reason that we shouldn't wow the protagonists a little bit with the sights and sounds of the Capitol, food included.
And they can look out the window and take in all the different restaurants in the district, all of the different festivals that happen with their food presentations. And, you know, they can see all that out their window and the train ride as they go.
So one of the things that happens is when Katniss finally gets here. Now, we all know that Katniss was a fantastic archer before. And In this case, we know that she's a fantastic chef now. But when they introduced her competitors, they all did something really cool. So can we come up with like two things that just culinarily are fantastic for these people to like intimidate Katniss?
One can make a mean souffle that never falls.
How tall should this souffle be?
How tall is a standard souffle?
Let's make it ridiculous. 2 feet tall.
Amazing.
Having a shot of one of the competitors looking Katniss in the eye while like flawlessly cracking and separating an egg in the shells, and then just doing that with an entire dozen, all while staring. I picture Katniss herself as the kind of person who can flip an egg without having to use a spatula.
Wait, how do you flip?
This is a trick that I taught myself because I thought it was cool. Yeah, you just have, if you have a small pan for frying an egg, you just like,
oh, that's
drop
what you
it
mean.
In, like I butter it a lot. To. And then, you know, you can kind of push forward and then lift. And it sends the egg whoop up the lip of your pan and then hopefully lands not hard enough to break the yolk.
Yeah, see, I do that with pancakes, but I never thought to do it with an egg.
You got to make sure it's really well buttered or oiled or whatever, because if it's not sliding, it's not going to work.
I think that would be very intimidating, someone looking in the eyes just flip.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Very quickly, they get into the first competition. For us, what's that entrance going to be like? Because that's kind of like an iconic thing.
Are we talking about the start of the game itself or at the point where everyone is introduced to the public?
Oh, we could do the public.
What's the name of that guy? Caesar, the host of the Hunger Games telecast or whatever. Caesar something or other. He's like a ruby rod, but post-apocalyptic. Caesar Flickerman. Bizarre name. Caesar Flickerman. I remembered it was weird.
I've just decided it's going to be Flip.
Oh, Flipperman. Oh. And the Caesar, that's for the salad.
Yes, of course.
PETA is still a baker.
He is still a baker, but he didn't get to practice very much because he didn't have the right ingredients. So this is his first time getting out there.
How does PETA feel about all this competition and all these people doing these amazing things?
PETA is nervous, but he feels like he has his knowledge that if he can just get out there and get the right ingredients to bake something, he could win this thing.
Wait. PETA bread.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, I'm afraid so.
That's why he's a baker. And that was the same way before.
It was.
You were about to come up with a pun for his name, weren't you?
I wanted to. And then I was like, wait a minute. It's just.
Sorry. Already done. Yeah.
Okay, let's move to when they actually get, like, pushed into the arena.
We need to know what the battlefield looks like here.
Should there be hidden ingredients? People have to find their ingredients in order to bake. They need to know what they're looking for, too, right? They need to have
a
plan.
Yes, there's got to be a procurement phase.
Are we talking grocery store level shelving or are we talking finding your ingredients where they belong, like going and picking fruits and vegetables, foraging and getting eggs, milking cows, like that kind of a thing?
Ooh,
I just realized our meat stuff has been blown out of the water because we have eggs. If Katniss was a genius egg flipper, then she probably had some experience with eggs.
What if all the eggs are imported and we never really see the whole chicken process? So they still don't have access to meat. They just have access to animal products.
Oh, what if they don't even know that eggs come from chickens?
That would take some learning.
Oh, so it's like a puzzle. I saw somebody working with eggs. Where did they get them? And it's like there's a chicken farm on the grounds, but nobody knows. That's where you need to go to get the eggs.
And Katniss is just running blindly looking for eggs. And PETA finds it when he goes to the next door. So he would go to milk the cows and he finds the eggs and tells Katniss.
And Katniss is like, I don't see a rabbit anywhere.
I could picture PETA actually having a cow, like his family has one dairy cow. It's like Milky White from Into the Woods. Like they're very attached to it and would never consider butchering it.
Butchering? What do you get from that?
Who knows? Butch, presumably. Right?
I guess maybe that would
You gotta give the cow like a short haircut and some jeans and a flannel. Uh-huh. And that's how you do it.
I don't know. I mean, I would never hurt my cow. Why would I do that? There's nothing to be gained from that, right?
That's just like the dog. You wouldn't hurt your dog, would you? Or your cat? No, you wouldn't. So
no.
I mean, honestly, a bunch of the people I know who do abstain from eating meat for, like, you know, personal or reasons of revulsion or aversion or, you know, health or morality, it's always like they know the moment in their childhood when they found out about where the meat comes from. We don't have to go there. let the parents handle that.
So Haymitch, that was Katniss's, mentor, right?
Yes.
What are we going to do with Haymitch?
You mean Samich?
Samich.
Yeah, just make him not an alcoholic and he's always eating sandwiches.
Did it?
And maybe he's a little mean because he lost in a previous year. Because after all, losers don't die anymore, so we don't have to deal with that.
Mm-hmm. Or he is a winner and he feels like all of the people from his district since have been kind of hopeless. And now he's like, oh, these kids are coming in. They don't know what they're doing. And he has no faith in them, really.
Until
they show promise. And then he realizes that he should help them.
Don't you know how amazing I am? I was the first person to put cheese and meat between slices of bread. I know everybody does it. Everybody Champion. Does it.
What's meat?
Oh.
It's okay. Lunch meat comes from somewhere.
Yeah.
It's in slice form. You don't have to worry about it.
Absolutely.
I have so many thoughts going through my head now that I'm like, what do I take first? So we should still have sponsors, right? The whole time they were trying to get sponsors to help them. Mm-hmm. That could be different brands that produce different things can be their sponsors and they can send different ingredients to the people to work with their stuff if they like them. Oh, this one looks really good. I'm going to send that baker pita. I'm going to send him some Splenda to make low sugar meals.
And pita's like, what do I do with this? They put chlorine in my sugar. I can imagine that in all this splendor of things that they're doing, they still need to kind of wear some label of these companies that are sending them stuff. So PETA accepts it, and now he's dressed in gold glittery stuff with the little Splenda logo embroidered on like the left arm or something like that. And he constantly has to be pushing it forward, his left arm, because he's being sponsored by Splenda.
I mean, just like NASCAR.
Yes. NASCAR. We need to do that for all of our TV people. They need to wear tattoos of who they're being sponsored by. You know what? I'm not going to say tattoos. Nice. Someday maybe I'll be lucky enough to get sponsored and I'm not getting a tattoo. Let's say wear a patch. You know, we can have politicians do it too. Just wear every patch of the people who've donated to them.
That would be interesting.
Could be a different symbol depending on the sponsor. Mm-hmm. Like possibly someone sponsored by the cabal leader, Betty the Croc, could wear a red apron to signify their loyalty. Stuff like that.
They could have stickers for their baking implements.
And it just becomes a mess of excess advertisement. Hunger Games really had a lot of excess in them, especially in the movies. They were far mm-hmm. beyond. And if we're going to make this a squeaky clean dystopian nightmare of commercialism, which is where we're going.
There you go.
Then mm-hmm. this is definitely where we need to go.
Perhaps even the food products have to have some emblem of, you know, like have you ever seen one of those cakes that had the edible images on them that have to have image of their whatever sponsor? And so but that's in the food itself.
In their final product. That's rough.
Mm-hmm.
That is very
they
rough.
They must have a sponsorship in their final product.
So back to the idea of what the arena is like. I think, Justine, you were the one who said they're foraging for their food.
Okay, yes.
So the running around foraging. What does one of the other contestants do to Katniss to try to mess her up?
They could switch the salt and sugar.
Ooh, that would work.
But Katniss, no, because she lives in the district where they make salt. So she would figure it out. this doesn't feel like salt. And she would save her meal that way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Hey, you know what? We have big flake salt at home, and this is very tiny. And she tasted, oh, it's sugar. Who put the sugar in the salt shaker? And then when she figures it out, she's like, ah, oh, we can have a camera angle of one of the other ones just giving her the eye, like, oh, didn't work. What is amazing about Katniss's dish here?
It has the perfect levels of salt.
Isn't it? Yeah. Well seasoned. So that is always something that they go over in these cooking shows. You have to be well seasoned.
And she would know how to do that because of the availability of salt in her district. So well seasoned. And if we're still going with the idea that she lacks money, it would be thrifty, but yummy.
After the first meal, a bunch of people get eliminated. Just like in the movie, a horn blows or whatever, and some people are eliminated from play. We probably have some more scenes of people getting all political. And what's the big political thing that people are worried about here? The kind of undertones of why this is so important?
I feel like it would be about getting available exports and imports of all their goods so that nobody goes without salt or without grain.
And the pepper district. Got to have a black pepper district.
Exactly. And they want it available to everyone. They think that it should be spread evenly across all the districts.
So how do we bring everything to a close?
I think that we need to bring back reference to what Katniss, we've established, is fairly good at, which is to say foraging. Perhaps something happens to a wide swath of the available ingredients near the end of the competition. And so the participants who had been more prepared to use every available ingredient suddenly find their vocabulary dramatically reduced. And Katniss has her time to shine because she's already been gathering things and she is the best at it. And she gets just enough flour to have there be a bread side that Peeta bakes.
If they're foraging for this stuff, there could be some danger from the outside world.
Well, what level of peril are we finding acceptable here? Because as long as nobody eats the poison berries could still be in play. They just can't kill anybody on screen.
Or maybe the poison berries don't kill people. They just, you know, give people slight food poisoning.
Maybe that's what happens to the ingredients near the end. One of the players distributed some of these delicious berries that make you very, very crampy to everybody. But Katniss, I know what those berries are. You shouldn't eat those.
Exactly, because she is good at foraging. She figures it out at the last minute and after everybody else has already used them in their product.
And she tells people, don't eat that, but they taste good. They taste good. They're very sweet and tangy, and they do this little numbing thing to my tongue. I love it. What could possibly be bad about these? And they start dropping like flies.
And we pan over to the bullies clutching their stomachs going, oh, on the ground.
And a line to the bathroom.
Yes, yes. Got to reference the scatological humor, even if we can't really go there.
I love that you used the most floofy technical term for toilet humor.
Exactly.
Very, very classy. So what I'm hearing is Katniss wins the competition.
Absolutely.
She gets through it. Now, here's where I forget, because it's been so long. She wins the first Hunger Games in the first book.
In the first book, she wins, but she wins with Peeta. Because she threatens that they would both eat the poison berries and that in doing so, they would both die and there would be no winner. So the district wouldn't want them to do that. So at the last minute, they award them both the win.
Are we in the same here?
It could be that Katniss is slated to win. Peeta is also slated to win. They made it together. You know, they each have elements in the meal. Probably it's too integrated to really work out. So they're going to decide it for one or the other, but they get a flood of calls from all of the people who have been watching who say that they want them both to win. So I think that it's one of those community coming together moments.
Maybe the reason why they get this flood of calls is because Peeta in some way helped Katniss with figuring out that last bit about the berries, because he tends to forage for sweet things because Baker.
Oh.
So maybe he figures something out with her that leads to them both warning everybody and nobody else listening.
These berries are, in fact, visually identical to another berry that is just kind of sweet and tasty. Maybe not as sweet as the poison one, but, you know, what happens is that PETA tastes the ingredient and realizes that it's the poison berry and warns Katniss, but is then, like, drops because he's eaten it and gets a really bad tummy ache. And so she has to finish his meal. Like, she has to finish his part of the meal. So that kind of puts him at a disadvantage, but everybody sees his heroic sacrifice and considers that a mitigating factor.
And because of the fact that they all try to warn everybody else, they're kind of seen as the heroes because they tried to stop everyone from getting sick. Yeah. That's a perfect addition. I love it.
That's a squeaky clean ending is what that is.
Yep.
So what do we call this new squeaky clean Hunger Games?
I feel like it could still be the Hunger Games, though.
Hunger Games is the one that Sesame Street did. So we can't take that.
Which was very funny, too. Maybe we can add a word to it, though.
The Hungry, Hungry, Hunger Games?
Like the Hungry Caterpillar?
Or the Hungry, Hungry Hippos, right?
Yeah.
The Hungry, Hungry, Hunger Games.
There we go. That's it. It's the Hungry, Hungry.
All right.
Hunger Games. All right. I can't say that.
I can
that.
Roll with that.
Now it's time for Industry, 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 where our contestants give us a interesting fact about working in their industry. Caitlin, what interesting fact and industry are you sharing with us today?
Well, of the many industries that I like to dip my fingers into, I'm going to go with game development. This does, in fact, spill a little bit into the other things that I do as well, and that is cultivate your community. A lot of game devs seem to feel like it's fine to just sort of let communities gather around your game without really engaging very much. And while to a certain extent that can work for smaller games, you need to be careful about what kind of audience you're building, regardless of whether you're trying to build them or not. A lot of games have particularly toxic communities that develop because there's no community manager for the game that they're a fan of. There's no community team. There are no mods assigned for any of the forums or Discords or whatever. And, you know, don't get me wrong, when you do introduce those things, you're going to receive pushback from the people who want to come in and kind of mess your community up. But that's why it's really important to have some kind of a hand guiding your community outreach and community building. This has been particularly salient and important for the development of Caves of Cud, where a really popular YouTuber covered us and we got inundated by trolls for a little while and had to lock down the Discord. But it turned out to be a very good decision, and we have since built up one of the most queer inclusive communities that I've ever seen for a game. We talk about what we stand for, and we expect our moderators to uphold those values, and it was a very good decision, and I want to recommend that everyone who's making a game that they expect to get popular more or less do the same.
That is fantastic. Taking a stand for the things that you believe in brings people who believe those same things together. How do we go about building that kind of community?
I would say that individual networking is a decent start. If you plan to be like a solo indie dev and you're just getting started, I mean, first of all, run. But second of all, what you want to make sure that you're doing is look for other dev teams or individual devs who like kind of comport themselves and run their community in a way that you feel is good, and just kind of watch them. If you have the opportunity to talk with somebody who is representing your values such as they are, as a representative for their game or their company, it's not a bad idea to see if you can make contact with them, or at the very least, engage with their work actively, review the things that they do, show up for them. And then I found that if you consistently show up for people, which is hard, and I don't always do it, but if you show up for people, they're more likely to show up for you. And I think that a lot of early on game dev networking is about that kind of individual showing up. because a lot of the time when you're starting, you don't have any resources, you don't have any people, you don't have any community to manage. What you do have is yourself and your name and your words and your reputation, such as it is. And you can have different reputations on different platforms. That's just the way it is. Talk to the people you want to be talking to you. Follow the people you want to be following you.
That sounds logical. Absolutely. And then the question becomes, how do you get these people? How do you even contact these people in the first place? I know for me, getting contestants for Word Crash, I had to throw out some of my shame and channel this story that is attributed to Benjamin Franklin. Like, you know how these things go. Stories get retold and whatever. And I don't actually know if this is something that Benjamin Franklin did. But supposedly, one time someone came to Benjamin Franklin and said, I want to start a bank. Will you give me money? And he's like, no. Well, if you won't give me money, how am I going to start this bank? And Franklin told him something that at first sounded dismissive. And what he told him was, first, what you do is you ask all the people who will say yes. Then you ask all the people who might say yes. And then you ask the people who you are absolutely certain will say no. And the guy was like, what do you mean? I said, of course, I'm just going to ask everybody. But what he meant was, ask all the people who you think will say yes and put their name on a list. And then you take those people and go to the people you're unsure will say yes and say, look at all the people who have said yes, and you'll get some of them. Then when you bring those two lists of people to the final list of people you thought will absolutely say no, you'll still get some of them. And that's how I have to approach getting guests for the podcast. I have to put away a certain amount of shame and go out there and be like, I know you're a YouTuber who makes their entire living off of YouTube, but I'm going to ask you if you want to be on my show anyways. And if they say no, they say no. I'll never be able to make those connections if I don't ask. So I have to ask.
When I was first getting started, I just made a whole bunch of tiny things and was like, the showing up became, hey, you want to look at this? And then people did or didn't. And then I'm like, hey, you want to look at this? And people did or didn't. And then gradually I start to be able to get feedback from people, provide feedback, talk about things, collaborate. Collaborating is a lot of fun. Game jams are a lot of fun. Great ways to get people to kind of invest in you. But yeah, you've got to engage people, even though it's very scary.
Being an author, not a game dev, I can't think of anything similar to a game jam. And there's NaNoWriMo, where people take like a month to do something. But I can't think of a game jam where you have like 48 hours to build something top to bottom, like 48 hours to write a short story. Boom. Do it.
There is something out there like that. And I wish I remembered the name of it right now, but it is an overnight short story program or something like that, where you come up with a short story.
Mm. I've known some exercises that can be good at that kind of thing, but it's not the same as a game jam. Game jams are definitely kind of their own thing and allow a degree of specialization that most fields don't.
Yeah, you could have someone doing art simultaneously as someone who's doing a physics engine or someone who's writing a tiny bit of story. We don't have that kind of multi-threaded, collaborative feel to writing books. In fact, getting anyone to collaborate with you on writing books at all is almost impossible.
Prose role play is actually a thing that I got into for many years, and I'm not really actively doing it right now, but I ran a sort of like queer superhero role-playing world that was done as prose. We were just writing in a document and taking turns and then occasionally going back and editing one another's paragraphs to like match character actions and the like. And you can get a rhythm. You can do it. You just have to have the practice of working with other people for a while and get them used to you. So it's a very different process, but yeah, it's not as common to encounter collaborative writing processes like that.
I have done something similar to that also. I would love it if those 100,000 words we all wrote together someday made it into a book, but I don't know. I don't think it'll ever will. The three of us wrote 100,000 words together. It was pretty amazing. Anyways.
Absolutely.
Justine, did you have a topic about your industry that you'd like to talk about today?
It's funny because mine sort of piggybacks off of Kaylin, which is the fact that a lot of people believe that writing is a completely solitary journey. But in actuality, it can be very not collaborative. We don't work necessarily in that way, but we do work in community. So it is extremely helpful. For me personally, I have editors and beta readers and critique partners and just people who are support more than anything. It takes a village to create a book. I mean, even whether you're doing it as a self-published endeavor in which you have your cover artist and your editors, and sometimes that comes in different levels as well, or if you're doing it with your publisher and you've got all the different people who work at the publishing company, marketing, the more people you have in your corner, the more support you have, the better you do. And in much the same way, it's very hard to find those people. But when you do, it makes everything so much easier. And also just the fact that it's not easy to do these things. And you can feel very lonely when you're getting rejection after rejection on a manuscript. Having people who have been through it as well, who can say, yeah, you know, that's really hard. Or yeah, I tried to do that too, and I had a hard time. Or even just people you can go to and say, I have this idea and I'm not sure what genre it fits in. Or I have this idea and what age group do you think it would work well for? And just bounce that off of a group of people that you trust. It's just such a huge help. So when people say things like, oh, well, you know, you write, and they kind of picture the idea of a writer as being someone who stays in their cabin alone and locks the door and just shuts everything out and works on their typewriter. That's not the modern version of a writer these days. I feel like now you really do need that sense of people around you willing to boost you and share the word about your book and things like that. It just helps so much.
Yeah, absolutely. I had none of those things. I wrote the majority of my book in one slab in like a year, and then it took almost a decade before I found someone who would read the book and say, oh, there's something here. Aaron Gallagher, who has been on the show now 3 times, has done a fantastic job, including Harley Quinn Medicine Woman, which is probably the show that has made me laugh the hardest while I was recording it, is the reason my book was published. That's it. It had been sitting around. I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't know how to do a second draft. I didn't know how to do anything. Didn't know what needed to be cleaned up. And she read it and she was just like, oh, no, this is great. Let's do it. And I was like, what do you mean, let's do it? What is there to do? So I totally understand, you know, the idea that it takes a whole group, because I got lucky that I found Aaron. Who knows? I mean, you write 100,000 words. No one's going to read your 100,000 word sci-fi novel if it hasn't been edited. Even once I publish it, it's still hard to get people to read my 100,000 word sci-fi novel. And now I'm working on the follow-up. And it's like, who's going to read it and understand what's going on if they hadn't read the first book? So now it's like, oh, hey, do you want to commit your time to reading 150,000 words until I write the last 50,000 words? It's tough. You got to tell me, how do people deal with that?
It's not an easy thing to find people, but I particularly have a small group of people that I share chapter by chapter with, which is a lot easier to swallow than a full 100,000 word book. The other way that you get people to do that for you is doing it for them. If someone is a writer who has written a story and they're looking for people to read it and they need an outside view, you donate your time and then ask that they donate theirs in return. A lot of times that gets you the people you need.
Justine, do you know of any organization or website or something that people might go to if they're looking for people to read their stuff or read other people's stuff and kind of get involved?
It's funny that you say that. So I am actually part of a writing organization. I am on the board of Write Hive, which is a Discord server community that we offer a lot of free services, and one of which is a query critique swap or a beta swap, which is just on the Discord server. We post about our work. And if anyone is interested in having a read and switching manuscripts, it's a super helpful program. And there's other stuff too. Like we have an annual conference and we have annual writing retreat, all virtual and all free.
Well, fantastic. That sounds great. Break out your thesaurus and grab your red pen, because it's time for Drop It. In this game, we ask our contestant to drop a single letter from the title of a book or movie and tell us what the new plot is. Kaylin, what letter is getting the axe today?
Well, today's letter is the letter A, the very first one of the alphabet, and the most hated. I'm getting rid of it. But specifically, our story today is about the crew of a corporate repossession vessel traveling in deep space, called to do a job when all of a sudden they stumble into restricted space and find themselves becoming the repossessed. And the tagline is, "In space, no one can hear you seize." And the movie is named Lean. That's L-I-E-N, a riff on Ridley Scott's masterpiece, which I was just rewatching earlier today, because any excuse.
For those who don't know, that's Alien.
Alien! Yes, we are changing the Nostromo from a Weyland-Yutani, I guess, survey vessel. I never quite figured out what they do. But Ripley, still a warrant officer, still on the ship, still resists breaking regulations when told to. But eventually the crew ends up with a biologically engineered repossession asset attacking their ship because they went somewhere they weren't supposed to.
How did we start off? How do we meet this crew?
Let's meet them the same way that we meet them in the original movie, which is to say, they're waking up from cryosleep. They've been awoken early because of a diversion that the company is asking them to make. And, you know, they're out in the middle of nowhere. They may have no idea where they are, but they have these coordinates now, and they are being asked to follow them, and everybody's complaining about it. The engineering staff has already had some disputes about payment, just like in the original movie. But nonetheless, the captain decides that they need to go repossess this mysterious alien spaceship. I'm going to say that that's where they find the, like, repossession biological assets, which are creatures designed to just take your stuff.
Oh, wow. So they're not the ultimate killing machine. They're the ultimate repo machine.
Yes, yes. Maybe they're capable of decompositing objects and then recompositing them back for the company. So they can eat your things and they're gone until they decide to, like, spit them back out.
This is incredible. I have this thing where you're looking through the alien's eyes, these genetically engineered wonders eyes, and they can just identify anything that hasn't been completely paid for.
They can smell debt. And here's the tricky thing. The Nostromo itself, their ship, never completed payments. So if they want to get home safely, they have to prevent the repossession of their ship, which is to say, I guess, being swallowed by an alien after it grows large enough.
And so these aliens, are they as creepy and, shall we say, phallic as the aliens from...
I mean, I'd hope so. No, I don't see any reason why the alien shouldn't be as disturbing and wet as it is in the original movie. And part of the horror is that it's getting its nasty drool on your stuff.
Oof. Oh. Oh. As somebody who very much dislikes drool, that is upsetting.
Wait a minute. Don't you have a new puppy?
I do. I know.
Oh, no.
But I dealt with it for my baby, so I guess I can deal with it for my puppy.
You don't have, like, a golden retriever or anything, do you? Is it?
No, thankfully. Not that it was my choice anyway. My son just glommed onto a puppy and that was it. It was ours.
That's how it works, honestly. Well, I'm glad you're spared that, but the crew of the Nostromo is absolutely not.
Kaylin, that was the most amazing segue we've ever had on the show. Just rolled right back into it. I'm just going to call it out. And I'm by calling it out, I probably ruined it. But whatever, that was the smoothest transition we've ever had.
You know, I'm used to making excuses for rambling. So maybe that's part of it. I'm like, oh, possibly. I can tie this back into our conversation. No problem.
So these drooly monsters that want to eat your stuff.
Yes.
In the average horror movie, people get picked off one by one. I think we probably should have their prized possessions, the things that they really want, get picked off one by one. Justine, what is someone's prized possession that they dearly love, that they actually haven't finished paying for, that would be the first victim of our repossessing aliens?
There are very fancy shoes.
Oh, very fancy shoes. Caitlin, how would that person react once their shoes had been eaten?
Definitely just like total loss of composure.
Would they know right away that it was the creature? Maybe at first they would accuse each other.
Yeah, maybe so.
What is that first thing that gets taken where people actually get mad at each other?
Well, we don't need to reinvent the wheel totally here, because we've got Ash the science officer, who knows most of what's going on from the very beginning and happily leads everyone to their doom. Yeah. And in this case, there's no reason that he wouldn't just watch all of this happen knowingly and perhaps conceal some of the things that he has seen. When things start going missing, Ash has an incentive to downplay it and to make sure that people aren't asking too many questions or trying to hone in on the creature before it's matured. There's going to be missing information from the outset as things start to disappear. That's likely to cause infighting between the engineers and the officers, which was a dynamic in the original movie as well.
How do they decide to fight back?
Oh my goodness, so much of fighting back just doesn't even happen in the first movie.
There's got to be some solution.
Well, yes, of course. There's going to have to be some solution. That solution may come in the form of divesting yourself of worldly goods.
Well, they would definitely realize that the ship itself is owned by the company and is being repossessed little by little. So they would have to find a way to survive without the ship, wouldn't they? And how could they do that?
Maybe they can figure out precisely which parts of the ship hadn't been paid for.
Maybe they take everything that hasn't been paid for, they stick it on a shuttle or something, and they try to eject it. Or something so ridiculously expensive that it's, you know,
That the creature will go after that instead of them.
To launch it out into space.
Right.
What could be worth so much that, of course, hasn't been paid for?
That someone would travel with.
Yeah. What if it's all the cargo that they've repossessed so far?
Well, we could also rewind time a little bit and have their original gig that they're returning from be to repossess something really valuable. And the reason the creature doesn't get it initially is because it's in lockup.
They use it as bait so that the critter gets onto the shuttle and goes after it. And then they lock it down and they eject it.
So, hold on. They own something outright that's super expensive, and they're going to split that. They're going to sell it and split that money. But instead, they're like, well, wait a minute. We have this really expensive thing. Why isn't it going after something that's expensive? What does it want? Because up until this point, it looks like it's been going after increasingly expensive items. And they don't realize that they're increasingly expensive items that haven't been paid for. So to give this thing a juicy mortal, they mortgage it. And they put it on a shuttle, and they launch it, and it's just like,
Perfect.
I also really like the idea. This is throwaway. I just want this somewhere in it. One of the characters has a photo of their family that hasn't been fully paid for, and when it gets eaten is when they lose their grip and get mad.
The photo hasn't been paid for?
Yeah, well, physical photos are very expensive because no one has them anymore. You just look at everything on your tablet.
Oh, I see, yes.
On your crappy retro futurist dot matrix screens.
That hurts. That's dystopian right there. So what is this item? What is so valuable? It's the future. Anything could be valuable.
A retro computer system. The original gaming system.
Like an Osborne or something?
An Atari. I was thinking an Atari, but yeah.
It could be like an old space war machine.
It's a Space Invaders arcade cabinet.
Yes.
And it's their prized possession on the ship because they got nothing else to do but play Space Invaders against each other and see who can get the highest score. And it's worth a lot of money. And so they have to give it up.
And there's the fun irony of the fact that they're ejecting Space Invaders into space to get rid of a Space Invader.
An alien, you think the alien is gone right when they blow it out of the airlock.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not.
No.
It's not.
It's not.
So can we have some kind of stinger here leading into aliens or liens?
Well, obviously, they have to find the eggs. At the end, they think they've gotten away, but shortly after they go into cryosleep to go home, you see a little batch of eggs in the corner of one of the cryo chambers, and that's where it ends.
And a little thing about what planet they're going to next.
And also, a little readout showing the balance incurring from their use of the cryostasis room.
Oh!
So they're incurring debt while they're in there.
And they didn't pay the debt because why not, right? They got all this money from mortgaging their Space Invaders arcade cabinet. They have plenty. Why would they do that? You know?
Exactly. Yeah.
They got to turn on buy another Space Invaders arcade system.
Solid ending. Very tantalizing.
Before we go, it's time to give our guests a chance to talk about what's new and exciting in their lives. Justine, what is new and exciting in your life?
My most recent release is the hardcover edition of my YA romantic comedy, Never Say Never, which is about a girl who is dealing with her parents' divorce and wants nothing to do with love and discovers that one of her really close friends is Aphrodite on Earth and considers that to be a challenge and takes that on. The soft cover was released a couple of years ago, but now we have the hardcover, which actually has added chapters and bonus features in it. So check that out. And if you want to learn more information about that or any of my other works, you can find that at justinemanzano.com.
First, congratulations on getting a hardcover done. I still haven't gone through the whole print process for my book and doing the hardcover. I'm just one of those things that I am not like particularly skilled at, and I'm doing everything by myself. And I'm always afraid of spelling mistakes, no matter how many times you go through it. Once it's in print and you have a spelling mistake, there's no fixing it.
Yeah. Yep. I had a chapter title spelling mistake at one point that we realized on, and I don't know how it happened because we all looked over the book, it's publishing company, and we missed it. Thankfully, when you publish print on demand, you can fix it before too many copies get printed. But yeah, so totally get what you're saying. That's a panic.
Aaron Gallagher had said that at one point they had a book come out with one chapter duplicated. So there's just two chapter fours.
Well, a fun story for me, I was doing a book signing about a month ago and opened up the book to sign it. And it was a totally different book printed in my book cover. The other books in the box were all right. I opened this one copy and there is a totally different book inside.
That's wild.
Uh-huh. And my assistant, which is my dear friend, was next to me. And I just said, and it was a self-help book. And she loves those. And I was just like, this is for you. And then took out the copy and like looked at it. I was like, okay, that's my book. And signed that one instead.
Mental note to always check. Now I know to always check.
I don't know what happened at the printer that day, but they just, one copy in a box of 25 copies, one copy had just the wrong book.
I would have taken that book. I would have read it. And then I would have written a review. I had never planned on reading this book, but it got printed inside of my book, and I just had to know what it was.
I told my friend to do that. I was like, now you have to read this and review it and like tell the story because it's too good.
Well, congratulations on all that.
Thank you.
If people want to find you on the internet, where can they find you, Justine?
Twitter, I'm Justine_Manzano. Actually, most places, I'm Justine_Manzano. I've recently discovered TikTok, although I'm not sure I should promote that, which is probably just more incentive for people to try to find me.
It is. It's certainly interesting to jump into an entirely new social media style and network.
I'm not convinced I have any clue what I'm doing, but we'll see.
I understand completely. So, Kaylin, what is new and exciting in your life?
Caves of Cut, the game for which I am additional writer and designer, is about to release a big update. We've been in early access for a long time. And we think maybe next year is 1.0? We'll find out. But the Moonstare update, which comes with a bevy of quality of life improvements and user interface improvements, it'll be dropping sometime in the next couple months, and the alpha is already available to Patreon subscribers. In addition,
Well, hold on. You can't drop something like that on our listeners and not give them more info first. The question on everybody's mind is, what the heck is Caves of Cud?
Caves of Cud is a retrofuturist, post-apocalyptic, roguelike RPG. So if you're familiar with roguelikes, you probably play video games. But for those unfamiliar, they are generated using procedural math and usually feature some form of permadeath, meaning you start over when you lose. Caves of Cud is set in a lush world of weird science, talking plants, layer cake of thousand-year-old civilizations, and lots and lots and lots of text, which I'm pleased to have been contributing to for a few years now. Less than half of the development cycle, but several years. Its art was very much influenced by mid to late 80s computer games, like the old Ultima games have a very similar visual style to the one that Caves of Cud cultivates. It also features a really surreal and strange soundtrack that cannot be described adequately. You've got to hear it. Really good music, really strange music.
And when Kaylin says, you use math to calculate all this stuff, even more than math is used in regular computer games, this would be the story itself is changed together through events that will not happen the same every time. Which I think is interesting to point out because that means there are certain challenges in writing that plot line. When we're writing a book or something, we know the hero is going to go here, then they're going to go here, then they're going to go here, right? And because of all those three things, we come to a conclusion. Whereas in something like this, it's like, well, you could code to B before you go to A, and you could go to C before you go to B, and now you have to write something that makes sense regardless of the order in which people attempt to do tasks. And I want to point out just how cool this is, that you know this thing that you're doing.
Oh, yeah. I've learned very much by studying under this lead designer, who is kind of a master of weaving together randomness and authored content. And a lot of what I've done there has been that process, creating working parts that can fit together in any combination to create a really interesting story, but the best stories are going to be the ones that we didn't write at all, just the ones that the players are experiencing while they play the game.
And you said you had other irons in the fire?
Yes, one more. This one's shorter because it's easier to describe. A lot of jargon involved in trying to tell people what a roguelike is. Not so much with this. My friend Jesse Sharon, who is best known for doing cartoons about mermaids, has started a project called The Other Happy Place. You can find it at Other Happy Place on Twitter. But be advised, it's very rife with body horror and existential themes that are challenging, to say the least. I get to be the narrative consultant on this project and have started writing scripts for it. And I think it's going to be really cool because Jesse's already released a lot of art, which you can go and see already. But we're starting to put together actual scenes and stories for a multimedia project.
Multimedia, that is not a word that I have heard in a long, long time.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those projects that is best suited to multiple different forms of media. There is an illustrated scrapbook type story being made, but we're also planning an exploratory puzzle game to play on the computer. So keep an eye out. It's Other Happy Place on Twitter. I'm Inurashi on Twitter. That's Inurashii. And that's my username more or less everywhere, including my Itch store, where a lot of my solo work lives.
You said something about being a VTuber. Can you explain to people what a VTuber is?
Yes, a VTuber is someone who uses an animated avatar to represent them while streaming. When I became an official broadcaster for Caves of Cud, which meant that I could stream directly to the store page, I put my face up and instantly regretted it. I jokingly said that I should become a VTuber because I was starting to become familiar with the concept of having a cartoon avatar to represent yourself. And then a member of the team said, hey, my sister rigs those. She can make you one. And I said, I'll take that deal. And so now I'm a cartoon hyena and I play relaxing games with lo-fi hip-hop music playing.
Love it.
It's that a is lot of fun.
Amazing. For people who don't know what an avatar is, it's basically you point your camera at you and the computer figures out if you've blinked your eyes or if you've smiled, and then it makes your cartoon counterpart in real time blink its eyes or smile. There's many famous VTubers right now. Some people are sharks. Some people are cat girls. They're everywhere. VTubers are a thing, and it's fun. It's like basically getting to play a cartoon character, which plenty of people want to do. That would be great.
And it's wonderful. You can even program expressions for yourself that you can bring up with a button press. You can give yourself props. You can give yourself backgrounds. It's lots of fun. And it gives your audience something nice to look at while you're playing the game. Not that our faces are not beautiful, but there's something very eye-catching about a cartoon character. But yes, I'm Grawstreams on Twitch because my character's name is Gra. That's G-R-A. And then streams, S-T-R-E-A-M-S.
Well, thank you, Kaylin. You have given us a look into a lot of different industries that we've never seen before. Here on the show, you know, we've had people who do streaming, but never anyone who was a VTuber. And we've had people who've done game stuff, but never anyone who is specifically a narrative designer. So thank you very much.
Well, I'm pleased to broaden the scope. And thank you for having me on.
So which pitch deserves a place in the Word Crash Hall of Infamy? Was it The Hungry, Hungry, Hunger Games or The Repossessive Adventures of Lean? You tell us, tweet us at WordCrashGame, and vote for your favorite story of the night. If you're listening on YouTube, remember to like and subscribe and get in those comments to tell us how you would tackle our questions today. Everything we talked about will be in the links below. Thank you for listening. I'm Megan, and this has been WordCrash. Remind you to always get creative.